Well, welcome, everyone. According to my clock here, it is the top of the hour, so we're going to begin with this first of our several session-long Healing Now series, which we're all very excited about. And we have an amazing guest to kick off the series, and we have another amazing guest to welcome him and introduce him. So I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Alex, whom you all know very well. And we'll get started, and then our guest will speak, and at the end there will be questions so we can all participate. So Dr. Alex, take it away.
Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody, for being here. We've been looking forward to this day for a long, long time, and this is a special day for me, and it's because one of my heroes is here today. I do not have many heroes, and I choose them very, very carefully. And I do not choose them based on fame, based on money, based on popularity. I choose them based on honor and integrity and making a difference in people's lives and things like that. And so we have one of my heroes here today, and he's been one of my heroes for a long time. It's Professor William Tiller from Stanford University. Dr. Tiller, there's a couple of things you need to know. This is one of my favorite all-time moments. You know, we have moments in our life that become treasures to us in our heart, and they bring power to us in our life from then on. And one of the really cool ones for me is, and this is the honest engine truth. Dr. Tiller, you're welcome to give your version of this if you want to. But the last time I saw Dr. Tiller in Arizona, he kissed me on the cheek. He kissed me. And I tell you what, my knees almost buckled for a very different reason. Obviously not a romantic reason, but it was a kiss of love, and I kissed him back, and that is the kind of man he is. It's not just that he's brilliant. It's not just that he's a genius. It's not just that he's changed the world through his scientific study for many decades. He is a loving, caring, compassionate man that is about helping people. One of the very first experiments on the healing codes ever done was done at Dr. Tiller's laboratory with a mutual friend, Christopher Haggerty, and that was a wonderful initiation, maybe, to me, as I was still searching for validation, and he was so kind to me at that time. So anyway, Dr. Tiller has written hundreds of scientific papers in the area of physics, books. He was one of the stars of the very popular movie What the Bleep a number of years ago. Was at Stanford University in the field of engineering and physics for many, many years, many decades, and is just one of the bright lights, one of the brilliant genius men on the planet. And thankfully for us, he is one of the geniuses who cares. And to him, it's not about just glory and money and popularity. So he's here today to share some of his wisdom with us about the physics behind health and healing. So without me taking up any further time, Dr. William Tiller.
Thank you, Alex. You are being very kind to me, and I do appreciate it. I do kiss one or two men, but I prefer females. Anyway.
Me too.
Anyway, your gal, Marianne Costello, asked me to write down a half a dozen questions that we could discuss. So I thought what I'd do is I'd start with that. And the first one I wrote down was, what is the difference between chemical medicine, energy medicine, and information medicine? And to answer that, I would like you to look at a visualization of a glass of water in which you put in some bacteria, and then you put in some silver colloid particles. There are little particles about a micron in size. That's 1/10,000th of a centimeter. And the silver colloid particles tend to kill the bacteria. And most people are aware of that. And what the medical community and the pharmaceutical community assumed based on that was that physical contact between the silver particle and the bacteria was the agent necessary to somehow kill the bacteria. And that really expanded the pharmaceutical industry, and it became known as chemical medicine. So that's where that one is, and it really relates to the thermodynamic activity, the chemical activity of the, in this case, it would be the silver in the solution of water. Now, that isn't quite correct. And the thing we did, or that was done to show what the correctness was to take a fluorescent tube and make the electrodes at each end out of silver and ignite the discharge, electrical discharge, so you can visualize light coming out of this tube as electric current flows back and forth between the two electrodes. And if you take a lens and focus some of this output light on this glass of water containing bacteria, you also kill the bacteria. That isn't particularly well known, but it's a very important fact, because what it shows is that it's not physical contact that's important to kill the bacteria. It is some one or more photons from the spectrum, the silver spectrum. Every material is always radiating a spectral distribution of energies, and these are in the form of photons. When the atom absorbs an electron, it kicks. Absorbs a photon. It kicks an electron up to a higher state in the atom. And when that atom drops back down to its normal equilibrium level, then it emits a photon of some particular frequency depending upon the energy difference between these two levels. And we see that it's at least one specific energy photon that is a particle of light which has no mass. All right? That turns out as the killing agent. And that leads to energy medicine. And one of the important areas of energy medicine that we see in today's world is what's called cold lasers, where these are low-energy lasers. They're actually from light-emitting diodes pushed into the lasing mode, and they're emitting photons of a particular frequency, green, infrared, blue, etc. And they are very, very important for the health of people. So they're often, if a person has serious skin problems or wound problems that aren't healing well, then use of cold lasers on that skin is remarkably beneficial in terms of healing. So that, as I said, leads to energy medicine, and there's there are all kinds of energies in use for the healing process. There's a third one which is important, and that's if we take this glass of water with the bacteria, and if we take one of our intention host devices, which is a simple electric system, and we, from a deep meditative state, imprint a specific intention into that intention host device. If the intention is, in fact, to kill the bacteria in that water, then we just take that little electrical device whose the any emitted energies from it, which is very small, they're less than 1/1,000,000th of a watt, then we just switch that on in the vicinity or the room where that jar is, and that kills the bacteria. So this is going to lead to what we'll call information medicine, and it can be used very much in the healing mode. All of these can be used in the healing mode, but this one deals with what you don't see. I mean, basically, it's information, and it's information of a very important kind, because generally, it's not so much the information of our normal day-to-day distance-time physical reality. It's at the next level of reality. It's at a level of the physical vacuum, and in the physical vacuum, there are many energies that we come to deal with. The coarsest one would be called the magnetic information wave level. That's part of my working hypothesis. The next stronger level would be the emotion domain level. The next would be the mind domain level. And then there would be the spirit domain level. So each of these has special healing characteristics. It all for particular problems in humans, some of which are at the spiritual level, some are at the mind level, some are at the emotion domain level, some are at the magnetic information wave level. That's the level at which the acupuncture meridian system functions. At the other levels, the human chakra systems, they function at those higher levels. So this is sort of what I'm looking at as the three present levels of medicine, and as I say, the magnetic information wave level, which is the information medicine, the beginning aspect of that, that's just going to be coming online within the next few decades. At this point, people are very much moving from the chemical medicine to the energy medicine. So we can either stop and have a few questions at this one. I can go on to the next question that I have written for myself. What would you like to do?
Dr. Bill, let's go on to the next question, and I'll ask that, and then we'll do questions at the end for kind of
okay.
Everything. So
right.
The next one, can the human qualities of consciousness, intention, significantly influence scientific experiments?
Okay, what brought this on is back in the early 1600s, Descartes, Frenchman, of course, made a very important assumption. Because we had just moved out of what we'll call a theosophical paradigm into the beginning of the beginning of science paradigm with Galileo, Kepler, Newton, Copernicus. So there's always an overlap when you move from one paradigm to another, and it can take centuries sometimes to get to the new paradigm, really having it operational. And Descartes saw this, and he said that he made this assumption that no human qualities of consciousness, intention, emotion, mind, or spirit can significantly influence a well-designed target experiment in physical reality. And that the purpose was to separate what we call religion from what we call science. And it was very effective in that regard, but it swept an awful lot of things under the rug. And that unstated assumption now is an unstated assumption because it's been held by scientists and medical people, because medical people, the orthodox medicine builds on orthodox science. And so that statement has not been tested in today's world. And there really is lots and lots of data that's been swept under the rug for the last century and a half. partly because that assumption. It's become an assumption. It's become kind of dogma. And so I was fortunate at the end of the previous century to have a philanthropist provide me with some research funds, and I decided to test that assumption. And I already had this procedure of imprinting a device, an intention into a device that could influence physical reality, change the properties of materials, really what I was looking at. And so I designed four target experiments and used the same kinds of rigor as I did with my PhD students at Stanford. The first two related to taking purified water, so we have a starting basis in which you could always go back to. And the intention was to be to increase the pH, that is the alkaline acidic balance of the water, by one full pH unit. That actually is a change, in this case a decrease, by a factor of 10 of the hydrogen ion concentration. So that's a big number. It also is a change in an electrical energy term of 23.6 millielectron volts. I mean, these things are all equivalents to each other. So it's a very significant effect. And the second experiment was to take the same kind of water and decrease the pH by one pH unit. That's an increase of hydrogen ion concentration by a factor of 10. And an increase in energy level of 23.6 millielectron volts. And it was to do this with no chemical addition whatsoever. Usually you change the pH by adding particular chemicals to them to make them more acidic or more basic. More alkaline. And we were very successful with both of those experiments. And so it was a very, very robust result. The next example was to take a liver enzyme, alkaline phosphatase, and to first condition a room to a higher level of reality with the intention host device, and then just expose the ALP, this alkaline phosphatase molecules, to that room for 30 minutes. And in doing so, we found that we could increase the thermodynamic activity, which we can experimentally measure, of this alkaline phosphatase in solution with water by 30%. That's a very big effect. And the p-value, that is the probability that this would occur by random chance, was less than one chance in 1,000. And then the fourth experiment, that one was in vitro. The fourth experiment was with fruit fly larvae. So that we're now dealing with a living system, and the intention was to increase the energy storage molecule, ATP, in the cells of the fruit fly larva, that the ratio of the ATP to its chemical precursor, which is ADP, that is 2 phosphorus in the chemical precursor to 3 phosphorus, in the ATP, that is to add another phosphorus atom to the original molecule, which is difficult to do. But we were able to increase the ATP to ADP ratio by a factor of 15% and therefore make these fruit fly larvae who were sitting in little jars of agar solution, which they like to eat. So the issue was that when you increase the ATP to the ADP ratio, our assumption was that they would be more physically fit and it would take a shorter larval development time to the adult fly stage. And so not only could we increase the ATP to the ADP ratio by 15%, p values less than 0.001, we found that we were able to decrease the larval development time to the adult fly stage by 25%. Again, with p-values better than less than 0.001. So these were four really robust experiments. And what that did, in my view, was very robustly prove that the unstated assumption of Descartes, which was held as dogma by most of the orthodox scientists of the world and medical orthodox medical practitioners, proved that that was absolutely incorrect, in at least in today's world. This kind of experiment wasn't ever done in Descartes' time. So that opens a door in a very significant way to what can happen. What is important to people is that they can change their reality through their own consciousness if they work at developing their own consciousness. That is, they can change the properties of materials. They can change the character of a room. You can make it feel like one of those wonderful ancient cathedrals in Europe that have been standing there having that gift available to people for thousands of years. Okay, that's question number two. So got a lot to chew on there.
All right. That is mind-boggling, Dr. Beal. That is absolutely phenomenal. I'm so glad you did those experiments. Okay. Are humans mostly conscious or unconscious?
That's an important one also. Things that most people don't know is that we have an unconscious and we have a conscious. Some people use different terms, but basically that's it. And the information handling capacity of the unconscious mind is more than a million times that of the conscious mind. The conscious mind has less than 50 bits of information per second. So the unconscious is at least 50 million bits, and that's just at the five physical senses level. So at higher levels, it makes the numbers even greater. So what it really happens is that the unconscious does almost all the work. It gathers the information that's abroad, and it manipulates it, maybe plots it up, maybe writes little synopses of it. But what it does then is it fashions little kernels of information which it are less than digestible, less than 50 bits per second, and it feeds them to the conscious mind. And it feeds them only along certain channels, only along the channels to which the unconscious mind has, or pardon me, to which the conscious mind has heretofore given meaning. If the conscious mind has not given meaning to a certain kind of information, then that information just gets dumped. It doesn't go forward. But if you give meaning to things, your unconscious will continue to feed you information along that line, and you will grow mightily by that particular aspect of your choice, of your intention of giving meaning to things. So it's as if there's a real blocker in there. If you don't give meaning to the existence of something, it will be very, very hard for you to gain information and insights about it. You're fortunate if you can have an experience of some higher dimensional reality event in your life, then maybe you would give meaning to these things. And then you will learn ultimately a great deal about them because you will be fed them. You will be awakened to them. That's really important for each of us to know because there's so much that we can do for ourselves. So.
Absolutely. Critical factor. So it's in a way, Dr. Tiller, would you say it's all about the meaning?
It's really all about the meaning, yes, and to give meaning to things. Look at your world you may not understand a lot of the things, but if you say to yourself, I think this is important for me to know, and you really give meaning to it, and you intend to digest that meaning, your unconscious will jump for joy and start feeding you along that channel. So what the answer to the question is, we are mostly asleep.
Yeah.
We're mostly, our consciousness is really minimal compared to the potential. And when we, a feature of my working hypotheses is that as we are finishing up the past to the present epoch of our reality, and we are moving towards the next epoch, then I think what will happen is that our present unconscious, with its millions of times more information handling capacity than our conscious, that in our future body in the next epoch, the conscious there will be this present unconscious, and we will have another consciousness, an unconscious level come in, which is probably something like 10 billion times larger than the next epoch's consciousness. So we will be have a stepping up in consciousness in that next epoch. And again, the same kind of rhythm will be worked out. Just like when I said we imprint these devices in terms of the information, the important information is not the electric atom molecule level, because it turns out that enters the mathematics by what's known as the Boltzmann constant. And the Boltzmann constant is so small that the ability to significantly intend things is very weak at that level. But the level of the next level, the magnetic information wave level, it has an analog to this Boltzmann constant, which is up by about a factor of 10 to the 10th. That's my assumption. That's my working assumption at this point. So we will be much more conscious in the next epoch, and therefore the things that we intend will have a hugely larger effect than in today's world. So today's world is a kind of a kindergarten learning process. We're just babes crawling across the floor of the universe. The future, each epoch that we go up, we will become more and more conscious, which means we're more and more powerful. We will get to the place where our consciousness will allow us to move mountains, really. I mean, it's a part of the physics of these next epochs that are ahead of us on our journey home to become totally coherent with the all, where all of us are part of the larger one. Okay.
I look forward to moving a few mountains with you, Dr. Tiller, and I love what you said about your unconscious jumping for joy. I've never heard it put that way, but I love that. All right. So the next thing, Dr. Tiller, how important are nature's distance and time-dependent laws to humanity's development of consciousness and spirituality?
Well, this is a very important one because our orthodox science and our orthodox medicine are stuck in distance time. Our experiments with these intention devices show that that the space has really changed. We lifted to a higher symmetry state in nature, and four of the things that we have found by our experiments. One is if we lift it far enough, we begin to see what's called a DC magnetic field polarity. In general, in our normal distance-time reality of today, we have electric monopoles. These are just called electric single charges. We have electric dipoles, etc. We have magnetic dipoles, which are induced by a moving electric current, but we have no magnetic monopoles. And there's been a lot of money spent around the world by really very good physicists with very good instruments and they haven't been able to find magnetic monopoles. Well, they deduced that that meant that magnetic monopoles don't exist. However, when we lift this gauge symmetry state to a higher level, we access magnetic, what appear to be magnetic monopoles. And so what one should deduce is that you can't access them from the simple distance-time world. That's a very important thing because it says, you see, our orthodox science community, what I was doing with my PhD students at Stanford for 34 years, that basically they're doing good work, but they're very restricted because of the internal belief systems and internal habits. You know, back in the days of Descartes, or even before that, the days of Galileo, the story is that the priests of the time wouldn't look through Galileo's telescope at nature at a distance. The reason was that they knew all the answers. They knew what the truth was, or they were afraid that they would be shown wrong, of course, but they wouldn't do that. And Galileo's experiments were correct. And so that led to the change in the paradigm. In today's world, the same kind of dogmatic view is existing in the scientific community. And they're not willing to step outside the box. They've got a lot of dogmas, and they won't look through the telescope in a metaphorical sense. They won't look at this kind of data. I have great trouble publishing these things. You can't really get them published in the normal literature. The answer of the editors is, oh, I'm sure my readership isn't interested in this kind of material. That goes on. So the issue is, here we are at a time when we're opening doors in humans themselves in terms of human consciousness and altered states of consciousness and human healing of people, both directly, close by, or at a distance, and through a telephone, etc. So what we're seeing in so much of what we'll call the parapsychological work, the healing work, is that they're not distance-dependent, and they're not time-dependent in the same way that the rest of science, orthodox science, is. And because orthodox science seeks to have internal self-consistency, and it finds this huge body of data, certainly in the parapsychological community and now in the healing community, that is not internally self-consistent with that, they either have to change the paradigm, which they don't want to do, or they have to sweep it under the rug and say, just poorly done science by quacks, etc. And that's not good for our future. It's because there's so many, these wonderful aspects of humans, or the human meat, you know, the raw meat of humans at the electric atom molecule level does obey distance-time dependent laws. But the higher consciousness aspects of humans do not depend on distance-time laws. So it says, here's this wonderful thing that's so important to us, and it's not being addressed, and medicine is not addressing it. Medicine is doing some great things, but there's a whole branch, the alternative and complementary medicine, and now energy medicine and information medicine, which are coming down the road. These things are really important to us, and so the paradigm has to change. And something big enough has to change the paradigm, because the orthodox scientists don't want to change it. The universities don't want to change it. The military would want to change it if it can be used in a wartime operation, but only very slowly. So it's a mindset that has to change. It takes a long time to change a mindset. It took a century before people were willing to accept the relativistic predictions of Einstein. So, and the same sort of thing with quantum mechanics. So quantum mechanics, people say, oh, sure, that'll answer everything. Well, it will not. It will not answer these human issues. It can't answer remote viewing. They've tried. They've spent billions of dollars looking to see things far away, a la remote viewing. And it's all failed. It doesn't matter what kind of quantum mechanics you use. None of them work on that because they're distant. The founding fathers framed quantum mechanics in distance time. And Einstein found in a distance time only world, things can't go faster than light. But a lot of, if you open your mind to something beyond that, you can begin to see that you can get faster than light results. So we're being held back from our future because of these unstated assumptions, or even having been stated assumptions, they are limiting. It's put things in a box, and the orthodox scientists will find if they get out of the box, there's huge things that they can understand. At the moment, they very much say, we don't understand dark matter. We see these effects on ordinary matter, but dark matter and dark energy make up now something like 96% of the gravitational effects that we see in nature. We expect on a distance-time-only relationship, then we should see deceleration of planets moving outward at the edge of the cosmos, but instead we see acceleration. So there's a whole variety of these questions that are easily understood and easily explained when you're willing to get outside the box. So I'm saying that indeed distance-time phenomena, as great as it is and as useful it is in many things, is limiting us tremendously with important questions that we need to address, and many of them related to the higher levels of humanity. That's the end of that one.
Dr. Taylor, one thing that encourages me about what you said, and I hope it's an encouragement to you, is, you know, your illustration about Galileo and how the other scientists, even of his day, would just kind of, you know, turn their head away and said, la, 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 you know, I'm not going to listen to that. They wouldn't look through the telescope.
Yep.
But we do know that today Galileo is looked at in a totally different way, and his detractors,
yep,
those scientists who refused to look at the truth in that day, they are now the ones that are looked at as the negative ones. And you know, when I've had a couple of negative things said about me over the last number of years. And that's always encouraging to me because I think, you know what, that's okay. I think someday in the future, you know, people are going to look back on our time and they're going to see you as the Galileo or one of the Galileos of this time. And I hope that that's encouraging to you, Dr. Taylor.
Well, it is, and because basically what is required from my side is I just have to leave a good record, because
right,
it may be that they won't get out of the box while I'm still in this earth plane.
Right. Well, that's
I hope
okay.
They do, but with the general public, they love this. They see hope, real hope for our future when they look at this kind of thing that I'm talking about, that many other people now are beginning to talk about.
You know, that's what I thought, too, when you said your thing about having difficulty getting these things published, and the editor will say, I think my people are not interested in this. Of course, you and I know they would probably be more interested in this than anything else they read in there.
Well, in terms of the general public, that part is true, I think.
Right.
They're the ones that are going, because they pay all the bills for the science
right
in this country. and the medicine, that aspect of the research. So ultimately, one day they will require through their congressmen and senators that this must change.
Right.
Because they want it, they feel they need it, and they should. Because the power ultimately is in their hands. And anyway, it'll happen.
Okay.
It will happen one day. I have no doubt about that.
Me too. Okay, let's do one more question, and then we'll move into some questions and answers. Dr. Tiller, can we experimentally measure? Oh boy, this one, I can't wait to hear your answer. This is such a fabulous thought and question. Can we experimentally measure a thermodynamic free energy change in a room due to human consciousness factors?
The answer is unequivocally yes. The device that we used in our experiments, which was measurement of pH, this acid-alkaline balance, it isn't that I'm interested in pH per se, but I'm interested in it as a probe, because when the pH changes by one full pH unit, then you have made an energy change in the space of 23.6 millielectron volts. So that as we condition a space to higher levels of reality, that is departures from the distance-time reality, in thermodynamic terms it's called the U1 gauge state, where the I don't want to go into complexity. Gauge theory is very complex. Particle physicists have done a lot of really wonderful work in that over the last 50 years. Most physicists don't even know quite what it means, and most other kinds of scientists definitely don't know what it means. But I've written about it. And on my website, there's 23 free white papers. The website, by the way, is Tiller, www.tiller.org. And so I've written about these things there in these 23 free white papers. There are also books for sale and DVDs for sale, but basically you can go there and just print out certain of these white papers. And they get into this issue of gauge theory state to describe it. It's hard to do over a telephone without figures. But the issue is that we have been able experimentally to change the pH by as much as 3 pH units. Each one of them, 23.6 millielectron volts, so that's something like 70 millielectron volts. I mean, that's very significant, and the ability in measurement of in millielectron volts, probably you can measure one part in 1,000, so you can measure microvolts. So it's very rigorous. It says that as you do this work, it is you change the space and you can measure that change. If we use our pH measurement system as a probe, then we have quantitative measure of this. Now we'd like to make a probe, which would be something like a voltmeter. It would be handheld. It would be all electronic. pH is wet chemistry, which is okay for trained scientists to use, but it's not really user-friendly for the general public. So we're working on trying to do this, an all-electronic system, so that we will have other probes of energies in the space, and then energies emitted by humans, because humans, if they develop themselves, take some of the Indian yogis and such, they have developed themselves such that, you know, 3 or 4 of them working together can do the same thing that we do with our devices, the intention host devices. And anyone can do that. It turns out that our experiments show that the acupuncture meridian system is already at this next higher gaze symmetry state. So human intention, when you make it strong enough, can increase the flow of magnetoelectric energy in that meridian system. That, by the way, is the scientific term for qi. Everybody in the audience has heard about qi. So basically, this helps us to understand qi, and the movement of qi through the meridians induces in the surround electric currents. And so you get electric flow of electric currents in our normal U1 gauge body. So this is sort of how we work, and at the higher gauge symmetry states actually feed energies into the chakras, and the chakras then feed energies into the acupuncture meridian system, and that feeds electromagnetic energy into the coarse level of the physical body. So we can do these things. At the moment, we don't have any research funds to do this because, again, you can't get these things from the military unless it is important for military work. And I don't want to go there with this stuff. I don't want to put it in the black. So the answer to that question is, the answer is yes. It opens up a new door. From our work so far, it looks as if we can enhance every technology that exists in the world today, whether it's machinery or whether it's human technologies like classrooms or hospitals, surgeries, any practitioner's office, any businessman's office, etc. So all of these things are in our future. They will be developed sometime during this century. And we will then move more confidently into the next epoch of our being. And we will then ultimately build starships that let us go faster than light and truly explore the universe, a la Star Trek. End of questions.
The last of human frontiers.
Well, it's not really the last, but it's the next step.
I think the last is internal.
Yeah. Exactly. When we develop our God self.
Right.
And we will do that down that path as we join in the coherence of oneness and truly become that one.
All right. I'm just blown away. I think everybody on the planet needs to hear this information. And one of the things you said, Dr. Taylor, is one of the main reasons why, is it gives such hope. I mean, people are listening to this right now who are struggling, who feel like they're at the end of their rope, who feel like, you know, I've tried all these medications, I've tried all these different things, and there's just no hope for me. Well, if someone listens to what you just said over about the last 40 minutes and understands it, I don't know how they can be hopeless anymore.
If they go to my website and look at the free white paper number 15 and print it out for themselves, they will see a lot of ways in which they can help themselves in terms of preventive medicine and just being able to heal themselves and heal others. White paper 15.
White paper number 15. And Ellen, let's be sure to give out that web address a couple more times before we're done here. Dr. Taylor, before we move into some questions from some individuals, I did want to ask you, everyone that's here today has in some way, shape, form, or fashion come through the healing codes. And you wrote me an email and told me your opinion, but would you share, if you don't mind, with the people on the call, your opinion of the healing codes? I know you read the book, and what do you think of that? Is that in harmony with what you've been talking about today? Anything you want to say about that?
Well, the thing I'd say when I read it, which was about the time when you were here, I was very encouraged by it, and I felt a kind of oneness with it, and it, because it is a kind of information medicine, and if you practice it, the thing that's interesting about the information medicine is a little bit complex. I think there will be a great expansion with of this as we go forward, but we, for example, learn something when we use our subtle energy detector device, the pH probe, in experiments working with Eric Pearl's reconnection healing workshops. And so visualize a situation where the teachers are on a platform speaking to an audience, and the audience is around tables where they're being taught how to do the exercises for reconnection healing. And we are over in a part of the room away from that, but our probe is in the room so that some information is flowing from that to our probe. And so you can imagine how this goes, that the students sit down and pay attention to the platform where a teacher is talking. And then after maybe 15 minutes, they get up and they walk around and they talk to each other and so on. And then they go back and sit down and then they get some more. So there are these cycles of sitting down, paying attention, and being up, relaxing, and walking around and conversing. We find with our pH probe that the thermodynamic free energy increases in the room. The magnitude increases when they're paying attention. And when they're up walking around, it decreases. Every time, boom, 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 we see this change. And so we looked at that data and thought about it from a thermodynamic point of view. The room temperature doesn't change by more than 5 degrees, plus or minus kind of thing. And in thermodynamics, the thermodynamic free energy which drives all processes in nature, there are several terms. The first one is pressure volume. That was used in the old steam engine days, and that's what's used today in compressors for refrigerators. Next term is plus the internal energy. The one you would know about internal energy is where physicists shoot particles at other particles in accelerators, and there's a big explosion and so particles go all over the place and they're measured. We've learned a great deal about the various particle energies. That's one example. There are just many examples of the internal energy. And then minus temperature times entropy. Now, if entropy is constant, geothermal energy is measuring the temperature between top of the ocean and floor of the ocean, and you can extract geothermal energy. So that's an important part. And with our information medicine, with temperature relatively constant, then it's the entropy that changes. And it turns out, since the days of Shannon, Claude Shannon, in the 1940s, he was the one that really connected information to bits, okay? Information in the form of words, information in the form of numbers, information in the form of a set of symbols, as in an equation, information as in the form of a it's terrible when you get in your 80s and you can't remember a simple word. where you're on a Sunday afternoon, you pull down a I'm having trouble with that word. A box with a bunch of pieces of a regular shape, and you put them together to form a map or something quite beautiful. Anyway, that's a form of going from an incoherent system to a coherent system. In any event, the What Shannon found when you look at the thermodynamic aspects of information, it is that if you have a process in nature where the information is increased during the process, such as learning something, which builds infrastructure into yourself, then it is equal to a decrease in thermodynamic entropy, which is, or entropy is disorder. So it means that things are becoming more coherent. And that's what we see, in fact, in these experiments when we do, when we lift the gauge symmetry state of a space using these intention host devices. So when we look at this thing, we have two main choices that in terms of the fact that something important happened when you do information. One is you change the internal energy, but usually what that means, it means you're heating things. For example, at room temperature, at equilibrium, every atom has its thermodynamic free energy raised by 300 degrees Kelvin, which means 300 degrees centigrade at room temperature. So in the magnitude of the effects that we were seeing experimentally, we would have had to have, if it was the internal energy contribution, we would have had to have increased the temperature of the room by somewhere between 300 and 600 degrees centigrade. Well, everything would be on fire. So, but that didn't happen. The temperature changed only maybe plus or minus 5 degrees. And therefore, the only other possibility, since the temperature didn't change much, was that it was the entropy change. And that said that what's going on is that information is being stored in the students paying attention to the teacher on the platform. And that's what is causing the thermodynamic free energy change, because if you're reducing the entropy, that means you're increasing the overall thermodynamic potential. I'm sorry if it's complex. It's an explanation in a thermodynamic sense, but it's a quantitative one, and it told me that what's really important, you begin to see something that's important for all of us to know. Many of us wonder why we're here on this earth. Part of it, a good part of it, is to build information into ourselves at various levels, whether we're going to grade school, high schools, universities. We're developing relationships. We're developing our musculature. We're business relationships, human relationships. All of these are building infrastructure into the various levels of ourselves. And that means we are reducing the entropy and increasing the coherence of ourselves, not only of ourselves, but our world. So it means that instead of this world becoming more entropic and us ultimately going cold and die, with humans, the possibility is that they create enough information in their development of self that the thermodynamic free energy of the entire planet, the entire solar system, increases, so we'll have billions of years more life, which we can enjoy.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm going to turn it over to Ellen, and we're going to move into some questions and answers if we have some from the audience.
Fantastic. Thank you, Dr. Alex. Dr. Teller, I have to say right off the bat that in addition to all of the information being absolutely wonderful and amazing, for me it was especially wonderful because it reminded me of my graduate physics student days. I was training to be a physicist years ago, so this was a great reminder for me.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you so much. So,
you're one who got out of the box.
Yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of us, I think, on this call who have been out of the box for quite a long time and are starting to make ourselves more known in that way. All right, so first of all, let me remind everyone that Dr. Tiller's website is tiller.org, T-I-L-L-E-R.org, and as he said, there are all kinds of wonderful free gifts for you there in the form of white papers with lots of information. He also has his books and DVDs and things available, so if you'd like more of this
PayPal
information and more. I'm sorry?
They can use PayPal.
Yeah, so, yeah, you can purchase directly from that website, and I know I'm going to be going there and browsing right after the call. Now, if you would like to ask a question, there are two ways to do that. If you're on the telephone, if you press star 2 I will get a signal that you are raising your hand, and then I will call on you. I will say the last four digits of your telephone number, and then call on you so that you can speak. And then afterwards, when you're done with your question, if you would press star 2 again, and if it doesn't mute, I will make sure it does so we don't have a lot of background noise. If you were listening via webcast, then if you write your question into the chat box there, it will pop up on my screen, and I will call on I will read the question for Dr. Tiller to answer. I noticed that there are a couple of questions coming in that really aren't specifically about this call, so I will take it upon myself to email answers to those afterwards, or how you can get your questions answered. So I see already we have a couple of people on the phone who have questions, so I'm going to call on from Santa Fe, New Mexico. The digits are 999-0, if you would like to go ahead and ask your question. Hello, from New Mexico. Are you there? Okay. It looks like I'm trying to find that number because I'm not seeing a number that was unmuted. So let me just see if I can locate it again. For some reason, you got muted there. Okay, so I'm going to – there you're unmuted now. Go ahead and speak.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, indeed. A little louder, though.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. You are just absolutely amazing, and I've read some of your – I'm just a body worker, and I have been, and read some of your stuff through Matrix Energetics. But that being said, Dr. Tiller, as a body worker, I read James Oshman's book, The Unscientific Basis of Energy Medicine. And
good book.
I'm not a scientist, but I really got excited when he was talking about the scalar wave potentials and in the body and being a body worker. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Okay. The issues are complex. First of all, there is the difficulty with respect to the term scalar waves.
Okay.
You know, when you have a new field and people don't quite understand, they use a buzzword.
Okay.
In material science, there was a period early on where strain and stress in materials, they found that there were discrete entities called dislocations. And what happened was that when people didn't quite understand something but thought they had a glimmer, they would say, oh, it's dislocations. Well, the same thing happened with respect to a term with respect to subtle energies, and they would call it scalar waves. Now, it turns out that the differential of a scalar usually means a non-vector system. And a wave generally means it's a vector because you've got one coordinate of distance, another coordinate change relative to some baseline like the Earth, and there's a velocity aspect. But basically the issue is it becomes a vector. And so most waves are vector waves. And to use the term scalar, it's a very special variety, but it's usually at a high gauge symmetry level. The dilemma in really saying what these things mean, let me give you an example. Think of the human body. Okay, there's the electric atom molecule work. That's one. That's the surface one that you're contacting in your body work. Then there's the acupuncture meridian system. There's no histological evidence of that, but there is evidence of the induced electric currents. So there's electrical stuff, but you don't see any cellular issues. So no histology on it. That we have already found is at the SU2 level, which is an important level above our normal U1 gauge. And the SU2 level is higher mathematics. It in mathematics and in quantum theory, for example, what we learn in school is called Abelian algebra. Okay, that's 2 times 2 is 4, or AB minus BA is 0.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get to the SU2 level, you find that AB minus BA is not 0. And you have to, in fact, go beyond vectors. You have to go to quaternions. So, and I'm not saying this to make it complex. I'm saying it to let you know that a lot of work has to be done by people. They have to understand the mathematics to be able to make meaningful statements about such things as the true scalar waves. Okay, they're in this very complex domain. So I think it is easier at this stage of our development to say we're dealing with subtle energies, which Jim talked about in his book a lot as well. And
mm-hmm.
the subtle energies are just energies in nature that are beyond those associated with the four fundamental forces that orthodox science accepts. That is gravity, electromagnetism, the short-range nuclear force, the long-range nuclear force. So at this level of our understanding, I have called everything else subtle energies. And until people learn how to deal with non-Abelian algebra and to deal with quaternions instead of even vectors rather than scalars, then it doesn't make much sense to me to talk about these other words except in the form of a buzzword, that you know there's something there which is beyond the conventional, but you can't say anything really precise without experimental measurement instruments or the proper kind of mathematical descriptor. Am I making sense to you?
You know, actually, you really are, and that's very helpful. And thank you so much. And please keep doing all your great work, because there's so many of us out here that nobody knows about that really love what you do.
Well, I thank you very much. And I'm learning about these things also, because that's where the work is leading me, that in order to be able to explain these important things, that I have to understand them and then write them on my website for people in a way that still won't be the easiest thing in the world to read, but some of them are, like White Paper 15.
That's excellent. Thank you, and we're all on this journey of kind of
exactly.
Just
we're riding the river together.
We're in this river together, and in the end, you know what? We just keep bumping into pure awareness. So let's at least have some fun on this journey.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
It's an adventure. The thing we can know is at the core levels of ourselves, we're absolutely indestructible. It's only the bio-body suit that we wear in order to communicate in this environment that has a limited lifetime.
All right, great. I had already muted that caller out thinking the answer was done, but thank you very much for that question. That was excellent. And we're going to go now to number 8351, or the last four digits, in Texas. You are live to ask your question.
Hey, Dr. Tiller, this is Debbie.
Yes, Debbie.
Hey, listen, this is really a tough question, because I've spent the last 30 years trying to understand this. And one of the things is I've always understood the power of intention.
Yep.
And one of the things you said is that to implant the intention to either change matter or cause healing, you tied it to a deep meditative state. Do you think you have different levels of consciousness in order to bring that about?
The answer probably is yes. The issue is, when we do this, and we do it quite often, we connect with an unseen dimension of nature. and with very intelligent life forms who, and we're sort of doing a joint experiment, but they do the heavy lifting. We are important in the process, and we give acceptance of being willing to do this in cooperation. I think they need to have acceptance before they can work in the world. So it is complex. The more you develop yourself, then the more you're quieting the interior, which means also you're becoming more and more coherent. The more coherent you are, the more deeply can you connect with the unseen. Now, the unseen has the energy levels to do the work through you. So I didn't mean to imply that you just have to have a device to do it. The goal, I think of the device as a training wheel that you can eventually set aside because you build yourself enough to do all these things out of yourself and through yourself. So everything you can do to make yourself more coherent is a step in the proper direction. We continue to use this approach because that's the way we sort of started. It was from a deep meditative state that we first were able to make that kind of contact, and then we cooperated with those higher dimensions of the universe. Now, let me give you an example. It's not quite the question, but it is meaningful. I think there are three branches to human consciousness. There is the ascending branch, which basically is growing in coherence, as we all do, by going to school, by playing in sports, by having physical relationships, having emotional relationships, business relationships. That we all climb that that branch. And if we're fortunate, we get to the point where the unseen thinks we're ready for the next branch, and that's the surrender branch. That's the branch that which you're willing to put your ego in service of a larger whole. So think of that as sort of a horizontal branch, the one that stops most humans from going forward. But if you do that, that is, you begin to realize that you can trust the levels of the unseen that you've contacted and are willing to serve the larger whole, then you do fine with that surrender branch. And as those two branches then continue going on, then comes the descending branch, and that's when the unseen works through you into the world. And that's kind of what the way I see this work that we do with imprinting a device. I asked a really good healer one day what they do in order to have such great success, and the answer was, I don't do anything, Bill. I just quiet myself and open myself to the universe, and they do all the work through me. So somewhere in there is the right balance of an answer.
That was an amazing answer. That was amazing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, lovely. Okay, so I'm going to go over to the web Q&A right now. Dr. Bill, are you still okay for couple more questions here? We don't have
a
lot, but yeah.
I'm fine.
Wonderful. So, and I just want to mention again the website to go to for all kinds of additional wonderful information, and Dr. Tiller's energy is written and personal, is tiller.org, T-I-L-L-E-R.org. Okay, so the first question is, there's someone wanting a little clarification as to what is an intention host device. Could you just clarify
okay,
that?
Okay, it's a little black box, if you like. It's the electronics in it. It has some quartz oscillators. It has some memory devices. It has a couple of diodes and resistors and capacitors, the kind of thing that you could get out of Radio Shack in the mid or even early 1950s. So it's not very sophisticated. And so there's a circuit board inside. White paper number 2 gives a drawing of the circuitry of that. So if you want to go to the website, and there's more information, I talk about it there, of that. But basically that's what it is. It's just, you can think of it, if you like, as a little particular black box that seems to be able to store this kind of intention imprint. If you talk and show that circuit to an electrical engineer, he'd say, this is baloney, that can't possibly work. Well, it does work. And that's probably one of the reasons why it works, is because it's not like our D-space, our distance-time circuitry. It has an aspect which describes the fundamental physics that I talk about, which is I talk in terms of, to expand distance-time, I had to invent a duplex space. And the duplex space consists of two subspaces that are reciprocals to each other. And one of them is distance-time. So the distance-time part is sort of our normal reality, and that's where I think the particle behavior should be. In the reciprocal, means like 1 over distance is number per unit distance, which is a spatial frequency. 1 over time is number per unit time. That's a temporal frequency. So it's a four-dimensional frequency domain. But that's where the wave part can be. And then there's a coupler, because the frequency domain, generally our experience is that things seem to go faster than light, and therefore you need a coupler from a higher dimensional domain that can tie these two together so that the faster-than-light part can interact with the slower-than-light part without violating Einstein's relativity requirement. That's how I see it working in that black box. In fact, it produces a flux of this coupler, which I call deltron. And that has consciousness in it. So it's a very interesting kind of thing. When I stumbled on this, I've been learning a lot about it as I do these experiments. But it didn't come from my orthodox knowledge. I hope that's helpful.
Mm-hmm. I hope so, too, and it's very interesting. Here's a slightly technical question about your purified water experiment.
Yes.
Did the water contain any minerals, or was it completely demineralized? I don't see how pH could be increased or decreased without the presence of conductivity.
Well, conductivity and pH are different things, and we measure conductivity as well. Okay, let me go back first. We purify it so that we have a baseline that can be even theoretically calculated. All right, so that's it. So we always start there. If you just put that water in the air, then within a very short time, several hours, the pH will go down to 5.6 because the carbon dioxide in the air will dissolve in the water, you will get hydrogen ions form, and that's the dominant source of the hydrogen ions. If you have demineralization, like in Evian water, there's a lot of calcium and magnesium carbonates in the water. So it's pressurized relative to the CO2. You open it, and the CO2 evaporates into the air, and then, in essence, you see it become more alkaline. So there's a lot of dynamics go on with this kind of thing, and you have to understand them. And the way that we found it easiest to understand was to purify to the highest purity possible for us. Our purification system cost us about $4,000. So we were serious. And So we start at that baseline, and if we want to dope it, you know, just the same way we had to, in order to do semiconductor work, you had to purify the silicon or the germanium and dope it the same way every time so you could get reliable results. That's the issue. Does that answer your question?
Well, this person is on the web, so I don't know, but hopefully. I think it was a great answer. Next question. This one is a little bit lengthy, and when I get long questions, I'm going to paraphrase a little bit.
Okay.
So what I'm understanding the gist of this question to be is, should I take literally my belief or imagination that I am going to walk on water and through matter, or is it, should I take it some other way?
Well, I think you should take it in today's world as a metaphor. I think you'll ultimately do all those things, but it may be in the next epoch or the epoch after that. And if you can do it in this epoch, bully. I mean, I think good for you. I'm not there yet. These are fruits of the spirit. To me, we are all spirits having a physical experience as we ride the river of life together. Our spiritual parents dressed us in these bio-body suits, and they put us in this playpen called a universe in order to grow in coherence, in order to develop our gifts of intentionality, in order to become what we were intended to become, which was co-creators with our spiritual parents. And on this river of life that we're riding, there's the next epoch and the epoch after that and the epoch after that, and somewhere along that path, we will probably be enough developed to spin planets out of ourselves. But it's a ways to go, and certainly walking on water is an easier step because that's basically levitation. Levitation appears to be a mirror principle operating between these two subspaces that I talked about, which I call D-space and R-space. D-space is space-time. And our space is reciprocal space. In the reciprocal space, what you have, because these are reciprocals of each other, is you have a kind of a mirror principle operating between them, so it seems. And the mirror principle is not a reflection mirror, it's an inversion mirror. So we have gravity in distance-time. We have levity in our space. So D space is gravity, levity is our space, and that would mean that when we learn enough about our space and are able to control that aspect of ourselves, we could draw in what I call magnetic information wave stuff, which is the coarsest level of our space, that then what happens is it will repel, the repulsion force between it and the Earth, just as the D-space matter of our body, that is attracted to the Earth, and that's why we're stuck on the Earth. We can walk, but it takes some effort. So when we draw enough of the magnetic information wave stuff into ourselves, we will begin to hover over the Earth, and we'll have to learn how to deal with the hovering aspect rather than being ground to the Earth. And at that point in time, indeed, we'll be able to walk on water. Is that clear?
It was to me. I thought it was a beautiful answer. Thank you, and thank you for whoever sent that in. Here's a question. Please give an example of the conscious giving something meaning and how the unconscious may feed it.
Well, the issue, it's a hard question to answer in detail because I don't know enough, but the issue, you give meaning to everything you do in your life. You're just not aware of it. I mean, you couldn't walk across the floor without giving meaning to the friction unconsciously, the friction that keeps you walking across the floor. Let me give you a sidebar, and I'll come back to this. There's a statement from the Eastern cultures that if you wish to create, it matters not in which medium you wish to create. If the medium offers you no resistance, then you can make no durable impression. So think about the aspect. Let's go to a classroom where there's a subject you don't like, and you don't want to give it meaning. You want to avoid it. And you start doing that, and you know that if you continue, you're going to fail. I have found, because I've experienced those things, that if I do that kind of homework first, that as I give it meaning, after I've worked with it for a while, I find I actually like it. So that's one example. Let's say you want to learn how to play baseball. You have to give meaning to being a hitter or whichever part you want to play, or a pitcher. You have to give meaning in order to put the effort into it, because it's an intention requires desire. You have to really want that. Before you want it, you have to give it meaning, but you have to see that it's important for you, or it is part of your desire structure. So that's, I think, a good example. Anything that you really desire, you have given meaning to. And when you give it the desire, then you're pumping deltrons, coupler, between the D space and R space. And your intention can have a big impact. Because first you've got to pump out of yourself some of these deltrons in order to couple with what you're dealing with. One of the things that happens as we evolve, for example, again, this is a sidebar, the placebo effect. 30 years ago, maybe 35 or 40, the placebo effect in nature was maybe 5 to 10%. Now it's 80 to 90. So that suggested to me that this deltron coupler is occurring everywhere in nature. It's growing slowly. And as it grows, it connects things. So now what you find, if you're doing a double-blind experiment, you have a doctor, let's say, you have a treatment, you have a patient, and you have a placebo. The placebo is there because it's thought to be inert. But if there's a coupler around, then the placebo is coupled to the client, coupled to the treatment, coupled to the doctor, and you have to think of them all as vectors. So you have, in fact, a system vector which has four parts, four subparts. And to get the intensity, because that's what you really measure, is the intensity, you have to multiply that four-dimensional vector with its complex conjugate. Sorry for the words. But what it means is that when those two are multiplied together, then you find that what you think is the inert placebo is intimately coupled to the doctor, to the treatment, to the patient. So now, even the term that's the treatment and the inert substance, they're like a slight modification of the treatment. So no wonder the placebo effect is like the treatment effect. The point behind all this is that as we go forward, the coupler is increasing and increasing in our world, which means that one person is connected to another person more strongly than it was before. One location is connected to another location thousands of miles away, much more than it was before. And so, in essence, and they're connected through reciprocal space. You're going to see a whole set and class of phenomena that you didn't expect based upon a distance-time relationship. And, in fact, it means you will not be able to do a double-blind experiment in the future because everything will be connected to some degree to everything else. Does that help?
Again, I think that was a wonderful answer. Yeah, I thought that was all very relevant and important. Hopefully the person who asked did as well. We have a question here that I'm not really clear on what the meaning of the question is, but I will I'll make an assumption. So the question is, have you studied Qigong, which
yes.
The Chinese have used for healing for 5,000 years? I suppose the person would like to know how you think or what you think is going on with Qigong or anything that you would like to say about it.
Well, First important step is meditation. Second important step is Qigong. The Qigong, the meridian system, is already at the SU2 level, and your intention can move Qi through that level. And the more you practice Qigong, the more Qi, or what I call magnetoelectric energy, will be available in the meridian system. And it's the same thing, that the more magnetoelectric energies that are available in the system, that means you have a greater ability to levitate. So you have less mass, gravitational mass effect on the Earth. So a lot of things enter here through that particular process. The Qigong, I think, is very important. Very helps in nutrition, helps all kinds of things. Once you learn to pump energy in yourself, which you're pumping basically through these meridians, you can change the nutrition of things. You can do all sorts of things with yourself, which what a Qigong master can do. My view is that as you work on these things, as you do the meditation, as you do Qigong, you can become an adept. And if you continue, you can become a master. And as you continue, you could become an avatar. That's the path for all of us, ultimately. Okay?
Great. Thank you. Are you okay to have a few more?
Sure.
So, Dr. Chiller, could you explain in terms of physics how different brain states, such as the theta state, and other states where there's a vibrational change in the body, cause healing and often spontaneous healings to occur? Thank you.
Well, as I show in White Paper 15, if you learn how to increase the flow of energy through your meridians and out your palms, you can heal yourself and others. So when you do the brain state work, you are enhancing your coherence. And the brain state exercises teach you how others have raised their altered states of consciousness, so that you can do them too. And you find that many things in your body are healed. You can find, if you do the heart math work, where you go into your heart and hold sincere appreciation for someone or something, if you continue to practice that, you will find that your electrophysiological system all entrains with the heart rhythm, which is at the barrel reflex frequency. So you become more coherent electrophysiologically, and you find that the chemical factories of the body, the DHEA production increases, the colon, that's not the right word, I forget, the counterpart decreases. And you find that in fact, if you put DNA in a jar outside of your body, you can, in fact, make it unwind or wind. And you can see that by looking at ultraviolet spectroscopy. So there are many things that you can do. But certainly, as far as is Qigong a good, worthwhile practice, absolutely right, in my view.
Okay. Wonderful. Yes, that is the last question I have right now. Let me just give instructions again in case anyone has a question and didn't hear how to ask it. If you're online, just write it into the chat box there and we'll get it. If you're on the phone, you press *2 to raise your hand and then I will call on you. In the meantime, I'll give out Dr. Tiller's website one more time. It's tiller.org. It's all kinds of wonderful information, including the white papers he's been referring to. This has been such a wonderful call. I think we may be at the end here. I'm not seeing any other questions. There were some other comments and questions that came in. I didn't feel that either that they were appropriate for this call because they were on other topics, or basically Dr. Tiller had already answered them in one way or another. So I will respond to those people by email so you feel at least that you were heard and that we saw your questions. And thank you, everyone, who asked and wrote in. Do you have any final comments, Dr. Tiller? And then I'll ask Dr. Lloyd if he has anything.
For me, it was fun. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the questions. And I am aware that you can get intellectual indigestions if you listen to me for too long.
Let me offer a last word, and then you can close it out, Ellen. Dr. Tiller, thank you so very much. There are a number of geniuses on the planet, but a genius with honor, integrity, and a caring, loving heart is truly unusual, and that's what you are. And you have been a blessing to so many of us for decades and will be for decades to come, because you are one of those Galileos that would be seen for many, 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 many years as a person who had the courage and integrity and the desire to help humanity to step out of the box, regardless of what anyone else said. And from that, we've all been blessed. So thank you so much.
I am in turn. As the healer heals others, the healer is healed.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, and thank you, Ellen. And if you want to close us out, that'd be great.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
God bless you all.
Yeah, blessings. And I would never call that intellectual constipation, because there was so much heart and so much spirituality in that talk.
Indigestion,
right.
I think. but the other one works too.
Or indigestion. I wouldn't call it that either. So thank you. Blessings, one and all. And thank you for attending. The recording will be available shortly to everyone, as well as an announcement about the next call on Thursday. So take care.
Okay.
Thank you all. Thank you, everyone.
My pleasure. Bye now.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye, Ellen. Thank you.